Good evening. This is Jack White of the WJR Newsroom, introducing another in a series of programs in which we bring you the tape-recorded highlights of events as they occurred today at the Detroit hearings of the House Un-American Activities Subcommittee. The hearings being held in courtroom number 859 of the Federal Building were highlighted yesterday, as you recall, by the refusal of seven witnesses to answer questions concerning alleged communist affiliations. Today, it was expected that in addition to the uncooperative type of witness, the subcommittee would call to the stand some friendly persons who would talk willingly. On hand at the hearings this morning with WJR engineers and recording equipment was Joseph Heinlein of the newsroom, who will now bring you a report on what happened during the morning session.
The willing witness who occupied all the morning session was former FBI undercover agent Harold Mickelson, who until last December was a member in good standing of various communist cells in Detroit and the Downriver area. His identity as an FBI spy, you may recall, was first revealed during the Smith Act trials last year. Today, Mickelson told how he'd been recruited into the Communist Party by a man named Clem Dalton, and almost immediately had misgivings when it was suggested he might want to use an assumed name. Committee counsel Frank Tavener asked Mickelson if he'd been using a false name in his communist work.
No, I was asked by Clem Dalton the night that I signed my membership card whether or not I wanted to use an assumed name. He said that some of the people used them for protection, and really some of the people didn't want to be known by their true names to even other party members. However, I said that I had nothing to fear, and that was the first thing that really gave me any suspicion that something was wrong with the Communist Party.
But in spite of these early misgivings, Mickelson went on with his work for world communism. He first took part in indoctrination meetings at a Grand River Party headquarters, and as his worth with the organization was established, he was given more latitude for his operations. By 1950, Mickelson was working almost entirely with the various foreign language groups in Detroit. These, he explained, are small cells of perhaps less than a dozen persons each, where the business can be transacted in each native language. One of these language groups was composed of Lithuanians. Here's how Mickelson describes his duties in maintaining liaison with one group.
Contact with the Lithuanian group was that I went in as assistant section organizer and spoke at several different meetings and sometimes led the educational program. We would usually read from pamphlets or something of that kind that were of particular interest of the moment, and then have a discussion around the article or what have you. Collect the dues from the club chairman, the financial secretary, and then the meeting was usually disbanded.
Do you recall the names of the leaders of in that group?
There was a Tony Gatotis.
Spell the last name.
Capital G-O-T-O-T-A-S. A Mary Giralt.
Do you know how Tony Gatotis was employed?
He was a railroad man that retired. I believe he's now on a farm someplace up near Battle Creek. There was a Mary Giralt, also known as Mary Chaputis. That's capital C-H-A-P-U-T-I-S. A Paul Zunis, capital Z-U-N-I-S. Then there was a lady who was known as Mrs. Brown, but I know that to be an alias, and I never did know her other name.
How many persons composed the membership of the Lithuanian group, if you can recall?
That Lithuanian group was the one I just discussed, and I know that there was another person connected with the club called the Old Man, but I never met the man and never had anything to do with him. He was, I believe, too aged to attend meetings or anything of the kind.
Do you know how many persons were in that club?
I believe that's about the extent of it.
All. You spoke of the Hungarian section.
That is right.
Our group of the Communist Party. Did you have occasion to attend meetings of that group?
Yes, I did. Quite a number of meetings.
Where were the meetings held?
Originally, they were held at the The Tofi or Petofi Club in Del Rey. That's a Hungarian club. We would meet there. Then, for a while, we met in a hall at Livernois and South Streets, a Slavish hall. We would meet very secretly. Each one would, due to security measures of the party, would approach the hall at intervals and go through the basement, go in the back door through the basement, upstairs through at the front of the hall, and into a cloakroom, which is adjacent to the stairway. Into this cloakroom, which has two doors, and we would bolt the door from the inside and continue and carry on our meetings in the cloakroom. But eventually, we again went back to the Petofi Club.
Who were the leaders in this group?
Alex Bahn, B-A-N, was the club chairman. Andrew Heck, H-E-C-K, sometimes acted as treasurer. Sometimes Mr. Bahn acted as treasurer as well.
After this list of names was entered in the committee record, Chairman Kit Clardy broke in to give assurances that any person named has a right to demand a hearing.
I interrupt, Mr. Shirley. Counsel.
Yes.
The witness has given the names of a number of people in the party, and knowing what's coming next, I know there will be considerable additional names suggested for the record. I want to make it plain at this point that if anyone named by the witness wishes or desires to be heard by this committee, they need only communicate with us, and at the mutual convenience of the witness and of the committee, such person will be afforded an opportunity to take the stand and say what he may wish to say. That's all.
Following Clardy's admonition, Mickelson went on to name other communists with whom he claims to have been associated in other front groups which infiltrated the Progressive Party in the Downriver community.
Eddie Lee Lampley.
Spell that last name.
L-A-M-P-L-E-Y. Harold Shapiro.
What was his function in that group?
Occasionally, Shapiro was supposed to be the financial secretary of the group, but he was very poor in attendance at meetings out in that area and eventually left that group.
Out of the Progressive Party movement grew a Downriver Citizens group, and Mickelson then continued to read into the record the names of communists he claimed were leaders of this organization.
World Downriver Citizens Committee was established by Tom Crow, Emmett McCormick.
Let me stop you there. That's the first time that his name has been mentioned.
That is the chairman of the Dearborn Club of the Communist Party.
All right, sir. Go ahead.
Joe Schrin. That's capital C-H-R-I-N.
Well, that's the first time his name has been mentioned. Will you give us more information regarding him?
He's the financial secretary for the club that was built based around building the Downriver Citizens Committee.
Was he a member of the Communist Party?
Yes, he was a member of the Communist Party, and as such was the financial secretary of that particular club of the Communist Party.
Very well.
Let's see. Eddie Lee Lampley was assigned to this particular club, but he wasn't too active. Myself, occasionally, Adele Schrin, the wife of Joe Schrin, that's capital A-D-E-L-E, capital C-H-R-I-N.
Now, will you tell us what the objectives of that group were in general?
Well, the objectives of that group were to promote the party in the Downriver community without the knowledge of the people in the Downriver community. That is, that I, as an example, in 1951, was living in public housing and was a member of the executive board of the Downriver of the Greater Detroit Public Housing Tenants Council. It was my function to work in that capacity, as well as aiding the formation of this Downriver Citizens Committee in River Rouge.
In other words, you adopted a title and a innocent-sounding name.
That's right.
To carry on the work of the Communist Party.
That is right.
You mentioned something about living in public housing. Were you the only communist in the public housing units where you resided?
For a while, there was this chap, Leo Perez, who dropped out of the party, and myself. Other than that, the project wherein I lived, I was the only communist to my knowledge.
You don't have any knowledge about how many may be in any of the other public housing projects?
Very few of them are left in public housing today in Detroit, I can tell
you. Well, I'm not talking about now. I know there's been a movement to get rid of them, but I'm talking about the time when they may have been.
Well, at one time, there were quite a number of us. We formed what was known as the Greater Detroit Public Housing Tenants Council, and there were people from a number of projects in connection with that.
That outfit was communist-originated and dominated?
That is right.
What was the purpose of that council?
Well, the purpose of that council was allegedly to combat racial discrimination in public housing, to allegedly aid the people in projects, keep rent down and things of that kind.
Well, what, when you say allegedly, what was its real purpose?
Well, its real purpose was the recruitment of members throughout the housing projects into front groups and the promotion of the party in general.
And thus the story repeats itself time and time again in Mickelson's chronicle of communist infiltration tactics. A hard core of Reds capturing and subverting legitimate organizations, perverting their efforts to serve the communist grand program. On that note, he recessed his testimony at noon.
And that was Joseph Heinlein reporting what occurred at this morning's session of the House Un-American Activities Subcommittee in Detroit. This is Jack White speaking. I attended the afternoon session and saw Harold Mickelson return to the stand when the subcommittee reconvened at 1:30. Mickelson continued relating many of the things and the people that he remembered during his Communist Party activity, and Consul Tavener returned to what he said later he believed to be a very important matter. It concerned an organization which had been passed over briefly during the morning hours, the Downriver Citizens Committee. The former FBI undercover agent said flatly that it was organized in 1951 by the Communist Party to get the FEPC issue on the ballot in River Rouge. He pointed out that innocent persons, not knowing of the communists who were part of and behind the committee, joined it and supported the party's proposals. The committee, he related, arranged for communist or fellow traveler speakers at various public events without the public suspecting. But the speakers and the communist powers in the Downriver Citizens Committee constantly promoted the Communist Party. Mickelson then was asked by Consul Tavener about the future of the committee now that he had exposed it.
As a result of this disclosure, which you're making now, of the manner in which this organization was formed and its character, what is your judgment from your experience within the Communist Party as to the attitude the Communist Party will take toward that organization, which now has been brought out into the light?
They'll drop it like a hot potato. There will be no Downriver Citizens Committee after this testimony.
Is that because this testimony will kill its usefulness to the Communist Party?
That is right.
So after today, probably, the citizens will have to be on the alert for some other very high-sounding title or name.
There unquestionably will be another front group formed in the Downriver area.
Mickelson was not excused until 3 o'clock, but just prior to that, Congressman Clardy made this statement.
Mr. Mickelson, speaking on behalf of the committee, I want to thank you for the contribution you have made to your government and to the Congress of the United States. We have the honor to represent in this proceeding. The information you have given us is of great value in our exploration of the entire field. I am sure that during your time as an FBI agent, you must have had a lot of uneasy moments, and there must have been a great many things happened to you that made you very unhappy. I hope that from here on out, now that the public knows about you and the sacrifices you have made for your country, that you will find much more pleasure than most of us have any right to expect. Thank you. You are excused.
And then began a parade of a different type of witness, the uncooperative kind who refused to answer questions regarding any alleged communist activity or affiliation. The first was Joseph Cramp, who identified himself as a printer. He had been named as a communist and asked, is he at present a communist? Cramp declined to answer. At this, Congressman Shearer broke in.
Well, the fact is you were a member of the party as late as November of 1953, were you not?
I respectfully refuse to answer that question on the grounds that it might tend to incriminate me.
Did you say the information we have that you were a member in November 1953 was wrong?
Under the Fifth Amendment, I respectfully refuse to answer that question on the grounds that an answer might tend to incriminate me.
Witness, are you now a member of any organization whose avowed purpose and aim is the overthrow of this government through the use of force and violence?
Under the Fifth Amendment, I respectfully refuse to answer that question on the grounds that an answer might tend to incriminate me.
Next witness, Curtis Davis of Detroit. The committee, by means of a photostated copy of a Detroit newspaper printed following the committee's 1952 visit, attempted to show that Davis was a district UAW committee man employed at the Dodge main plant. He had been named, according to the paper, by Berenice Baldwin as a member of the auto section of the Communist Party. The union suspended Davis but reinstated him when he signed a non-communist affidavit. Davis refused to answer on all these questions. And Clardy then asked one more question and received a tirade in response.
Are you aware of the fact that the Communist Party does advocate the overthrow of this government through the use of force and violence?
I'm aware of the fact that where I work, there's some 22,000 people that is laid off out of work with compensation running out, with no place of work. Children are hungry, and they want jobs. And that's what I'm interested in, and I think the people where I work and the local union where I come from, I'm more interested in those problems.
Well, now be interested in my question, please. Will you answer it?
Well, I can understand that that's the statement of this committee, but I'm still refusing to answer that question.
Very well. Do you have any further questions, Mr. Taverner?
No, sir.
Witness excused.
The next witness proved to be the most uncooperative of the hearings so far. His name was Ben F. Cosell. You will note through the testimony, as Cosell refuses to answer, that Congressman Clardy and Shearer insisted at times on his answering certain questions. They wanted his refusals on the record for what they indicated may later result in a charge of contempt of Congress. Cosell was asked what his educational background was. He declined to answer. Where did you live prior to 1939? Another refusal. It was evident the members of the committee were becoming irked. Both Clardy and Shearer, and on the other side, Cosell, took no little time in becoming irritated.
Now, please subside. May I point out to you, sir, that this committee is charged with a grave responsibility.
That I'm aware of.
And we will not...
Serious.
Now, will you please subside, sir? We cannot, and we will not, as representatives of the Congress of the United States, permit any disturbance of any kind to take place in this courtroom. Now, if you will be courteous with us, we will be with you. We will not in any way attempt to compel you to do anything. You may answer or not as you see fit at your own risk. But from time to time, the chair may find it advisable to give you its opinion as to whether or not you are properly invoking the Fifth Amendment if you do so. We give it to you in all kindliness so that you may not at any time claim that you were taken by surprise at anything that may eventuate from this proceeding. Well, may I explain something to you now, and perhaps you will have a better understanding of why the request is made and why the chair directs it. It has been the policy of this committee in laying the foundation for possible contempt actions to always ask the witness the question, if he refuses, and we think improperly invokes the Fifth Amendment, we then give him one further opportunity by the chair directing that it be answered. It's a formality, sir, that we must go through with. There's no intention to be insulting to you or to imply anything whatever. We are merely trying to help you by giving you an opportunity. Now, I have directed you, and I understand, to cut this short, that you have again refused. Am I correct?
Right.
Very well. Proceed.
You have advised the committee as to the place of your residence since 1939, but you're unwilling to do so as to prior to that date. Is that what I understand your position to be?
I refuse to answer for the reasons previously stated.
Now, did you serve in the armed forces of the United States prior to 1939?
I just want to get a little clearer on that question. When you speak of the armed services, I was a midshipman in 1934, United States Naval Reserve for 4 years. Is that considered being...
Surely. When did you say you went into service in 1934? When did you come out?
I received my commission in the U.S. Naval Reserve in 1938.
You were, I believe, at that time at Northwestern University.
I'd just like to know how this question is, you know, material to this, this work, to the work of this committee.
I must direct you to answer the question.
I refuse to answer under the rights of the Fifth Amendment.
Now, you were in the service from 1934 to 1930.
Pardon, Mr. Tavener.
Excuse me, sir.
Witness, I wonder if you won't reconsider. Surely you do not want to leave the impression here that holding a Naval Reserve commission and admitting that you did and the other things connected with it could in any way incriminate you, do you? And yet that is the nature of the objection you are raising.
I would like to read what Judge Carroll C. Hinks...
No, we shall not entertain
appeals,
that. We are more familiar...
1954.
May I point out, we are more familiar with the law than you are. You are not an attorney.
Oh,
as I understand it, it's your position that an admission connected with that would... with the Naval Reserve would incriminate you. Am I...
I refuse to be a witness against myself. And I don't see any need for any inference of guilt or of, criminal proclivities when I resort to the Fifth Amendment.
Very well. Proceed, Mr. Tavener.
Going back and reviewing what you have testified to in order that we... may understand it properly. I understand that you served as a midshipman from 1934 until 1938 when you were given a commission in the Naval Reserve. Now, were you recalled to service at a later date? In fact, weren't you recalled
to
service in 1940?
Look, a lot of taxpayers' money are being wasted here. Same answer, same reasons. No?
You will not state whether or not you were recalled to service, active service, in 1940?
Repeat the question.
I say you are refusing to state whether or not you were recalled to service in 1940?
I don't see what this question... What relevancy it has to these hearings here? I think it's just a waste of time.
Well, the chair directs you answer that question.
I stated same reasons, same answer.
How long were you on duty after having been recalled to active service in the Navy?
Same reason, same answer.
When did you again take up your residence in Detroit?
Same reason, same answer.
I think we should keep this record right. Would you direct him to answer that question?
Yes, I so direct. Hmm?
To what?
Pardon?
Excuse me, sir.
You were directed to answer that last question.
I invoke my rights under the Fifth Amendment, refuse to answer.
To what rank did you attain after being called to active service in the Navy?
I don't see what relevancy this line of questioning has on these hearings. I think there's a real problem here in Detroit. There are thousands of unemployed. I think the committee should be looking into this, not into what I did in 1940 or 45.
Counsel Tavener informed the witness then as to why he was asking questions concerning Cosell's Navy service. He asked if it were not a fact that the witness had not been other than honorably discharged from the Navy. That question also Cosell declined to answer. It was apparent then that the committee attempted to tie Cosell with a recently shut down Polish consulate in Detroit. Congressman Cardy asked if the consul were not a close personal friend of Cosell's. Refusals to answer. And then this question by Counsel Tavener.
Were you given a loyalty hearing prior to your release from the Navy?
I refuse to answer. I invoke my rights under the Fifth Amendment, which guarantees every citizen a right to refuse to answer without any inference being drawn as to his guilt or not guilt.
Hard not to draw an inference from your conduct, my man.
What's that?
Hard not to draw an inference from your conduct.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. A little louder.
Proceed, Mr. Tavener, and pay no attention when this witness attempts to indulge in what he thinks is something very smart.
I'm a little hard of
hearing. Now, will you please subside, sir, and answer the question? Proceed, Mr.
Tavener. Of a bomb burst.
You're willing to talk about that, but not about anything else. Proceed, Mr. Tavener.
Were you a member of the Communist Party, or had you been a member of the Communist Party at any time prior to your release, the release of your commission by the Navy?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment and refuse to answer that question.
Mr. Kosel.
Cosell,
I beg your pardon.
I insist on the correct...
Yes, sir, I want to make it
correct. Oh, I'm on that. That's not always been your name, has it?
I refuse to answer.
Cosell lost his temper when Congressman Scherer intervened with a question, have you engaged in espionage against the United States?
Russian.
And I resent that slur that you throw in my direction. I don't think you have any right to even as much as impugn my patriotic beliefs. Well, I believe in the Constitution of the United States and that flag, and I will fight all its enemies, within and without. That's my answer.
We can hear you without being so emphatic, but you have not.
I resent that slur. I think it was a slur to ask me that question.
Never mind. Now, listen to me carefully.
I'm going to listen to you very carefully.
Very well.
And I want you to listen to me carefully, too.
You have not yet answered the plain question as to whether you have engaged in such activities. You may either say yes or no or invoke the protection that you have been invoking all along. Now, in justice to yourself, if you have not engaged in such activities, an unequivocal no is all that is required.
We have heard your speech. Now,
pardon, let me finish. We have heard your speech. It's recorded in the record, but you have not yet denied it. Now, I suggest that in your own self-interest, you should do so if you have not been so engaged.
I invoke my rights under the Fifth Amendment and refuse to answer that question.
This has been the second in a series of daily programs recording highlights of hearings being conducted in Detroit by the House of Representatives Un-American Activities Subcommittee. Tonight's commentators were newscaster Joseph Hainline and WJR's news editor, Jack White. Again tomorrow evening at 9:30, the Goodwill Station in the public interest will bring you another transcribed resume of these hearings.
This is WJR, the Goodwill Station, with studios in the Fisher Building, Detroit.
The following transcribed program is presented by the Goodwill Station in the public interest. At this time, WJR presents the third in its series of program highlights from the Detroit hearings of the House Un-American Activities Subcommittee. This afternoon, your reporter was news editor Jack White. This morning's session was reported by newscaster William Sheehan. Here's Mr. Sheehan.
The morning session in room 859, Federal Building, Detroit, consisted of testimony, or lack of it, from three witnesses: James Jahocke, Bulza Baxter, and Bernard Bellinson. Baxter's appearance took most of the morning. The first witness, a mild-mannered, heavy-set man of 36, who identified himself as James Z. Jahocke, the president of UAW CIO Local 742, the Chrysler Auto Body Plant. Jahocke, appearing with counsel, politely refused to answer any and all communist questions with this statement:
I plead the immunity of 59.
Witness number two, Bulza Baxter of Detroit, the 28-year-old chairman of the Labor Youth League. You may recall Baxter's appearance Monday caused a stir when his attorney, Milton J. Henry, was ejected from the hearing room for what Chairman Clardy termed trying to take over the session. The subcommittee was ready at this morning's session. Here is Baxter being sworn in.
Hold up your right hand.
Mr. Chairman.
After you're sworn, I'll permit you to address the chair. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? So
I do.
All right, now.
Will you identify your counsel and then...
You may. Would you identify yourself with counsel?
Well, my name is Milton R. Henry. I represent the defendant Bolton.
All right, will you both be seated now? And I understand your counsel, your witness has a remark he'd like to address to the chair, and he may do so.
First, Mr. Chairman, I would like to ask for a point of clarification.
Baxter's point of clarification concerned why he was not called first, the order he understood would be followed. Opening formalities having been cleared away, it was time for the first question concerning Baxter's connection with the Labor Youth League. This answer to this first question set the pattern for Baxter's subsequent testimony.
I think I should make it clear at the outset that anything you ask me within the scope of the authority given you by the enabling resolution must necessarily be of such a nature as to come within the purview of either the Internal Security Act of 1950 or similar acts. Such acts are penal statutes, and the Fifth Amendment forbids inquiry into past conduct which may be construed by this committee or any other committee as penal in nature, except after presentment or indictment of a grand jury. I invoke the due process section of the Fifth Amendment as well as other sections of the Fifth Amendment and will refuse to answer any questions that this committee may care to ask me. I further decline to answer any questions before this committee and invoke my privilege under the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment against testifying before a committee whose powers derive from a resolution void under the First Amendment, as well as my privilege under the First Amendment to be free in the exercise of my rights to inquire, think, and speak from either prior or subsequent congressional harassment through hearings, investigations, reports, subpoenas, or through other devices.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I ask that you direct the witness to answer the question.
Yes, I so direct.
I sought to make it clear at the outset.
I asked you directly, this witness, to answer the question.
I understood you.
Will you keep quiet just a minute?
Well, you keep quiet. The question had already been put to me.
After some words were exchanged on orderly procedure and the value of not interrupting, witness Baxter indicated he wanted to answer questions in his own way, and Chairman Clardy followed with some suggestions.
Congressman Clardy, this is supposed to be a hearing, my hearing, as well as yours. Now, I'm entitled to answer, respond to the questions in the way that I feel is responsive. I'm as concerned with the taxpayers' money as you are, but I don't want the newspapers to say tomorrow that Baxter used the Fifth Amendment 57 times. I may use it 57 times, but I'm going to use some other things also.
Well, witness, may I give you a suggestion or two? If you desire to object, or rather refuse to answer, on the ground of the Fifth Amendment or any of the other amendments, even though we do not recognize them, you're entitled to state that fact. State that first. And then, if there is some explanation which the chair deems relevant and pertinent, we shall not cut you off at all. Only in the event that you attempt to make a stump speech, so to speak, as we have heard many times, will I interrupt you at all. Now, let's get back to the question.
Bolza Baxter was well prepared for the questions the committee asked. He refused to say whether the Young Communist League was dissolved in 1949 and replaced with the Labor Youth League. Baxter refused any questions regarding his own Communist Party activities, and the witness thusly rejected the committee's demand for records of the Labor Youth League.
I have... Go ahead.
I have not admitted being either a member of, an officer of, or being in possession of any records of a Labor Youth League, and a yes or no answer to the question posed would tend to imply or would lead the inescapable conclusion that I am in possession of such records, which I will not do, and I will assert the answer previously given for the previously stated reasons in refusing to respond to the question, and I will make the additional, I will invoke the Fifth Amendment also in refusing to respond to that question.
As far as the House Un-American Activities Subcommittee was concerned, Baxter was at times a trying witness. It was plain the congressmen were going out of their way to avoid grounds for charges that Baxter was being treated unfairly. At one point, Representative Shearer became irritated.
Mr. Chairman, I suggest that this is not a laughing matter. I think the record should show that counsel and the witness, when they confer, have been laughing and smiling.
I don't know how the record can show that, Congressman.
Well, I'm saying
I mean,
that
based
I
on what you observed, I take this as being a very serious matter, and I don't think it's your right to determine whether or not we smile or frown. You have smiled.
Mr. Baxter, I told you earlier, we possess...
I have a right to consult with counsel, Congressman.
Now, may I have the floor for a moment? As I explained to you, we have infinite patience. We have to have on this job. But if you choose to treat it lightly, as Congressman Shearer seems to think it does, that is entirely up to...
Now,
hold still just a minute, please. I'm not trying to be arbitrary with you, and I don't think I am.
But you're trying to put me in jail, and this man is saying I don't take it serious. What the hell do you think?
I think it's a typical display of the communist tactics.
I don't care what you think it is. You're trying to put me in jail, and I insist on my right to defend myself, and there's no laughing matter.
I was calling your attention, son.
Now, Mr.
Son,
Baxter,
I'm 28 years old, Congressman. So don't address me as son.
Please,
as the hearing progressed, Committee Counsel Tavener read into the record some testimony given to Chairman Plardy in executive session. Testimony concerning the Labor Youth League, Baxter, and the Communist Party. When questioned as to the correctness of the closed-door testimony, Baxter had this to say.
I would like to move that the question be stricken. I object to any testimony being introduced here by some stool pigeon who I have not had the opportunity to confront nor cross-examine. I think if somebody's going to accuse me, I have that right just as well as McCarthy and the rest of the people demanding it, and I object to the introduction of such testimony, and I think it should be stricken.
Direct the witness to answer the question asked by counsel.
Yes, Mr. Baxter, you are directed to answer that question.
What was the question?
He knows the question.
Hold up.
Hold
just a moment. Mr. Baxter. Mr. Baxter.
Yes, sir.
I have a question that will supersede the one posing. If you do not know the question, then on what basis did you say what you did immediately preceding that?
Well,
you obviously are either misstating the fact as to whether you knew what the question was, or you said something without any basis whatsoever. The two cannot stand. Which is it?
First of all, Congressman...
No, just answer the question.
I'm going to
Did you understand the question?
I'm going to answer the question.
Did you understand it?
I understood the question at the outset, and then there was an exchange, and then you directed me to answer the question. So I want to make sure I understand what you are directing me to answer so that I can respond properly, in my opinion.
Proceed
now, that is the purpose. There was no other motive involved in my asking for it being restated.
Proceed to answer the question. I'm sure, and I say this knowing full well that it may invoke something from you, but I am sure that at the time you said you didn't know the question, you did. Now, will you proceed to answer it? Because I'm certain you know what we're trying to get at.
I will not answer it until I have the question restated. There's been quite an exchange.
Right, well,
I want to be sure
to answer.
What I'm
proceed,
asking.
Mr. Tyler.
I refuse to answer, invoking my privilege under the Fifth Amendment and the First Amendment.
And then more testimony from the committee records, more objections from witness Baxter. It might be well to point out here that the name Jack White came into the hearings this morning, a name well known to WJR listeners. Congressman Clardy stepped in at this point to clear the record.
Since there's a Jack White of very prominent fame here in town, better make it clear you're not speaking of WJR's Jack White.
Shortly after that, the end of Bulza Baxter's testimony. Next witness was Bernard Bellinson, an employee of the Ford Motor Company, a member of UAW-CIO Local 600. Bellinson, too, refused to testify on the grounds of not just the Fifth Amendment, but also on amendments numbers 1, 4, 6, 9, and 10. That was the morning session. Now for the afternoon report, here's WJR's news editor, Jack White.
First witness before the House Un-American Activities Subcommittee at the beginning of the afternoon session today in Detroit was William H. Johnson, recording secretary of Ford Local 600 of the UAW-CIO. Johnson was a cooperative witness in that he did not at any time invoke the Fifth Amendment nor refuse to answer a question for any reason. However, the committee members felt that he could have volunteered more information about his knowledge of communist attempts to infiltrate the union. William Johnson stated that he had been chairman of one of the local union's progressive unit caucuses, that he had met with former Michigan Communist Party chieftain Carl Winter in an effort to call off the communist disruptive tactics within the union. Committee Counsel Tavener asked several questions with a view toward getting Johnson to admit alarm at communist objectives at the Rouge plant without success. And then the subcommittee counsel introduced, in an effort, as he put it, to acquaint Johnson with a dangerous to the union, a document which had been obtained from a former communist listing not only the communist objectives, but specific objectives of the party in the so-called Dearborn Auto section.
This is a rather extensive document, Mr. Chairman, which has come into the hands of the committee staff only recently, and which is now being made public for the first time. And it points up at the hand of the Communist Party itself the main objectives of the Communist Party in your union, Mr. Johnson, as well as other automobile unions.
Counsel Tavener stated that he would read portions of the document and directed that copies be given to the witness and the newsmen, in the courtroom. Of specific interest was this portion, as read by counsel, regarding the area's auto plants.
The next is a heading at the top of page 3, for a drastic improvement in the work among General Motors workers. This is a precondition for further advancement in auto. General Motors employs 350,000 auto workers of the 1 million within the UAW. Saginaw Valley, comprising Flint, Pontiac, and Saginaw, is the heart of the General Motors empire with 150,000 auto workers. The city of Flint has some 56,000 General Motor workers. Flint is the key to moving the General Motors division of the UAW, the division which Ruther heads, and therefore the key to striking a powerful blow against social democracy. Whatever develops in Flint has great influence on the entire UAW. The UAW convention exposed the weakness of our party's industrial concentration method of work in auto. The anti-Ruther forces did not have a majority base in any one of the auto's big three, where party work was on a relatively higher level, as in Ford, the anti-Ruther strength was greatest. In GM, our main national concentration sector, the progressives were weakest of all. Flint and Pontiac, with strong anti-Ruther forces in the past, were Ruther strongholds in this convention despite the mass dissatisfaction of the GM workers with wage cuts, increased speed-up, phony umpires, and frozen contracts. It's therefore clear that we need a drastic improvement in our work in auto. In the first place, in our work in GM, without in any way curtailing our work in Ford, which remains our main concentration point in Michigan's Wayne County. In other words, Mr. Johnson, there's the statement of the party that, as far as the party is concerned, Ford is the main concentration point.
Counsel Taverner continued to read excerpts from the documents which Detroit newspapers are referring to tonight as the master plan by which the Communist Party hopes to gain a stranglehold on the automobile industry. Committee members paused to point out that the introduction of the communist material was connected in no way with William Johnson's appearance on the stand. After hearing much about the document, Subcommittee Chairman Kit Clardy directs Counsel Taverner to read a certain paragraph.
And now I want you to read the next paragraph there, because it, in my opinion, is as short a summary as I've seen as to the cold-blooded determination of the Communist Party to take over through that method. Now, will you read that?
Yes, sir. Industrial concentration is the basic method and approach toward everything we do. Issues and tactics will change, but the role of the working class is general, and
in
of
general.
The workers...
Working class in general.
In general, and of the workers in basic industry in particular, is a constant permanent element in all industrial concentration plans or objectives. Industrial concentration is the method of work of the party of a new type. Finally, industrial concentration is not a seasonal occupation. It is not a method of work that we will use only for a period of time. It is a permanent method of work.
Well, now, Mr. Counsel, I think I should comment this time that this, I believe, is the first time this committee has been able to place its hands on a communist document in which they have admitted, as they do here, the prime importance to them of taking over in this area particularly, because they regard it as the key to everything. I think this document has more significance than almost anything else the committee has uncovered in all its years of operation.
Explain some of this colonization we were talking about.
That's
this
right.
Morning.
And they
sending
yes.
communists from other part of the country to infiltrate the local auto unions.
And I want to bear down heavy in this record on the fact of the last in contain the last sentence you read, that it is a permanent method of work to do just exactly what they are suggesting in this document. In other words, it's not a part-time job. It's not one that will cease when our committee or other committees are on the job exposing and then resume the moment that our back is turned. It'll be carried on continuously without break or interruption. And therefore...
It'll be noted, Mr. Chairman, that the word permanent is underscored for
that's
emphasis.
Right. And it also, in the preceding paragraph, they speak of the word method as having importance because they underscore that when they are talking about the fact that issues and tactics may change, but this method that they're talking about is the key to everything. Proceed.
After more discussion about the communist master plan for Michigan, witness Johnson was asked whether he had observed any indication within his local union that the communists were pursuing the objectives noted.
Well, I looked over this document during the recess, and the impression that I gained from looking at it is that they state that their objections on page 2, there are 8 objectives listed there. And as they would relate to my union, one of them says to stimulate the broadest united front actions of employed and unemployed. Well, at that time, I don't recall there being any unemployed in our plant.
So I really don't see what they're driving at as far as our plan is concerned. If I recall correctly, in 1949, we were at a pretty high peak of employment. We had no unemployed, that I can recall.
The second point had to do with the strengthening of the working class, and Johnson answered that he would have to be familiar with Marxism to figure what the communists were driving at. Then he continued.
On the third point, to heighten the unity of Negro and white workers, well, as long as I can recall, there's always been a great degree of unity between Negro and white and the local union. We have never had any major racial problem within the local union since the union has been organized and formed.
That phrase, now, white chauvinism, then, had no application, certainly so far as you observed it, in your local.
Well, I really don't know what they're driving at is white chauvinism.
Well, it is a rather obscure, but it's a mouth-filling word that they use continually to foment trouble between your race and mine, sir. And I'm sure that, and from what you're saying, you've observed no such thing in your local.
No, there has never been any situation. The only time there was any racial problem at all in the local was prior to the formation of the local during the strike in 1941. There were a substantial number of Negro workers and other workers, perhaps 20,000 of them, that remained within the plant during the strike in 1941. And a substantial number of those were in the foundry unit because a percentage of them mistrusted the union at first because of the discrimination that was practiced in unions generally prior to the inception of the union at Ford. And other than that, I don't recall of any period at all where there was any racial tension within the local union, not even during the race riots in Detroit. And of course, I wasn't here. I was in the service at the time, but I've been told that there was no untoward accident at all or incident at all within the confines of the Rouge plant.
The local 600 recording secretary was asked a little later on this question.
Well, had you been a member of the Communist Party at any time?
Yes, I was in 1942. 1943, I believe.
How long did you remain a member of the Communist Party?
Well, I'd like to state this, that in 1942, in November of 1942, I was fired by the Ford Motor Company for allegedly refusing to instruct a group of workers to return to work who had walked off their job. Actually, I had simply told the fellows that they had to make the decision themselves. I wasn't going to tell them to leave the job. I wasn't going to tell them to stay on the job. I thought they had a just grievance. We had a grievance in the file. But I was fired because they claimed I refused to undertake an obligation to make the men go back to work. I was fired for about 2 months. That was in November, I believe, of 1942. And I was reinstated in January, I believe, of 1943. And at that time, I was pretty sore at the Ford Motor Company, I guess, because I felt I'd been unfairly discharged. I hadn't done anything that I thought was a justification for the discharge. And in resentment, I did pay 50 cents for a membership in the Communist Party. A month later, I was inducted in the service of the United States Army and was there for 2 years.
Did you reaffiliate with the Communist Party on your return from the Army?
Well, in 1945, I was approached by an individual who told me of the formation of the Communist Political Association. And I understood that it was a political party that had changed its old stand stand and position and was cooperating with the government of the United States, was not a party of communism as it had been in the past. And based on that assumption, I joined it.
Johnson said he continued a member of the Communist Political Association until early in 1946, and that he quit when his attempt to get Carl Winter to halt communist disruption at the plant produced no results. At the conclusion of his testimony, William Johnson was given this tribute by Congressman Scherer.
Mr. Chairman, while I think this witness, if he wanted to, could give us a great deal more information than he has, I think he's to be complimented for answering most of the questions fairly and fully and not using the Fifth Amendment to avoid answering the pertinent questions, at least.
Next witness was George L. Ellery. Asked if he were a member of the Labor Youth League, he refused to answer. In fact, he continually refused to answer seemingly uncompromising questions, and the committee constantly requested that he do answer and appeared to threaten citation for contempt. The witness referred to a question about a communist school as a political question, and one committee member asked him if he had served in the armed forces and obtained the answer yes from September of 1950 to May of 1951. Then followed this exchange.
Did you serve out your full period of enlistment?
No, I did not.
For what reason were you discharged so early?
I was never given an official reason.
Did you receive an honorable discharge or a dishonorable discharge?
I did not receive a dishonorable discharge. I received a general discharge under honorable conditions.
When was it that you picketed the Army recruiting station here in Detroit?
I assume you believe that this is a political picketing. I therefore refuse to answer on the same
ground. Well, I don't know what kind of picketing was, but on February 7th, 1948, our information indicates that you picketed the Army recruiting station in Detroit. Did you so picket it on February 7th, irrespective of your reason?
I will give the same reasons and the same answers as I did before.
Next witness, Paul Ross Baker, who also declined to answer questions, ran into the ire of the committee for refusing. He would not say whether he had attended Michigan State College, nor whether he had gone to school under the GI Bill of Rights. He would not state whether he knew Bowles of Baxter, reputed chairman of the Labor Youth League. Finally on the stand, Mrs. Evelyn Gladstone of Garden City, who willingly answered many of the usual questions about background and vocation, but balked when asked if she were a member of the Better Schools Committee of Garden City. That's when Congressman Clardy issued a blast against some of the legal advisors who had appeared with their clients during the afternoon.
Well, I must say, the chair is moved to say that today I have seen the worst type of legal advice given to witnesses appearing before us than I have ever heard before in all the time I've been on the committee. Now, I want to ask you this. You are, in fact, an officer of that organization, aren't you?
Are you asking me a question, Mr. Chairman?
I
must decline to answer the question for the same grounds as previously stated.
I direct that you answer it.
But Mrs. Gladstone again refused and likewise declined to answer this question, how long were you a reporter for the Communist Daily Worker? That concludes this program of highlights from today's hearings of the House Un-American Activities Subcommittee. Tomorrow, no hearings. All three congressmen, Clardy of Michigan, Scherer of Ohio, Mulder of Missouri, will be in Washington voting on the St. Lawrence Seaway Bill. Hearings in Detroit will resume, however, at 9:30 Friday morning.
This has been the third in a series of daily programs recording highlights of hearings being conducted in Detroit by the House of Representatives Un-American Activities Subcommittee. Tonight's commentators were newscaster William Sheehan and WJR's news editor, Jack White. With the conclusion of today's session, the hearings have been recessed until Friday. So listen again Friday evening at 9:30, when the Goodwill Station in the Public Interest will again bring you another transcribed resume of these hearings.
This is WJR, the Goodwill Station, with studios in the Fisher Building, Detroit.